Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a Valley resident with an ambitious goal to read 100 of the best books of this century.
And Western governors met in town over the weekend. Are they any closer to consensus on a host of important issues?
But first, President Trump has put forth a new nominee to lead the Bureau of Land Management. His first pick, Kathleen Sagama, withdrew her name from consideration back in April after it was revealed that she had been critical of Trump's role in the Capitol riots on January 6, 2021. The new nominee is former New Mexico Republican Representative Stephen Pierce. If confirmed, Pierce will have a lot of influence on public lands here in the West. For a look at his resume and what it suggests about how he might lead the Bureau, I am joined now by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach. Hannah, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Hannah, to start, remind us what exactly the leader of the Bureau of Land Management does.
Yeah, so they're nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and this leader has the authority to provide direction to the BLM and all of its field offices. So the BLM manages 245 million acres of land. That's like about a tenth of all land in the U.S. Wow. And it's more than any other land agency, like the National Parks or the Forest Service. The BLM also manages 700 million subsurface mineral acres, too. So unlike national parks, the BLM has this dual mandate from Congress. So it has to conserve natural, historical, and cultural resources, but it also has to manage public land for multiple uses. So, you know, there's recreation, camping, rafting, hunting, that kind of thing, but also timber harvesting and renewable and traditional energy development. So in the past few years, the Biden administration has tried to restrict that oil and gas development. But now with this new potential leader, Steve Pierce, we could be going in quite a different direction.
Yes. Well, let's talk about Stephen Pierce. He's a former congressman from New Mexico. He also ran unsuccessfully for governor there in 2018. What does his tenure in the House of Representatives suggest about his point of view on public lands?
Yeah, so he's the former chair of the Congressional Western Caucus, and in that time, he really pushed to privatize land. During the Obama administration, he co-authored this letter to Congress pushing to sell or lease more public lands for oil and gas drilling to offset the government spending deficit. In that letter, he said, quote, over 90% of this land is located in the western states, and most of it we do not even need. He's also tried to limit the expansion of national monuments. So in 2012, he called for the reduction of the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument in southern New Mexico, which was designated by President Obama. He thought that was roughly like 500,000 acres. He wanted to reduce it to like 50,000 acres. big cut.
Yes.
And yeah, he also used to operate an oil field services company before, and potentially he did some of this work during his time in politics.
So as you mentioned, Hannah, now that Pierce has been nominated, it will be up to the Senate to confirm him. What has the response been from Senate Republicans to Pierce's nomination?
Yeah, so in my state, Wyoming Republican Senator Cynthia Lummis, right after the nomination, she came out, sent this press release. She called Pierce her friend and said his nomination is a major win for Wyoming, the entire West, and she urged a swift confirmation. Then Montana Republican Senator Steve Daines, he told Politico that he really likes the fact that Pierce is a Westerner. He said it's important for these leaders to understand the challenges we face as it relates to federal, state, and private land. And he said that Pierce has lived it and breathed it.
And Pierce's politics, from what we know in his past positions, even outside of land issues, are pretty far to the right, correct?
Yeah, I'd say that's correct. He questioned the results of the 2020 election and basically said following the January 6th insurrection that none of that was really Trump's fault.
In your reporting about this, you spoke to a representative from the Western Energy Alliance, Aaron Johnson. Let's take a quick listen to what he told you.
We think that Steve Pierce would be a good director at the Bureau of Land Management. He comes with a strong background in public lands policies and has a record of advocating for multiple uses on public lands, which is the mission for BLM.
So, Hannah, we heard Aaron Johnson refer to multiple uses there, but based on what you've been telling us, help us parse what he means by that.
Yeah, I mean, he said this is kind of the exact kind of person we need for this position because it's somebody who prioritizes energy development, which, you know, by the congressional mandate, that is what the BLM is supposed to do, in addition to managing for conservation and recreation and timber harvesting, all those other things. But like, it is the BLM's role. We'd have to go through an act of Congress to take this out of their job. Johnson also highlighted that a lot of revenue from energy development supports a maintenance backlog in national parks, for instance. So he really said, like, we need to be making money here to support this recreation on public lands.
Yes. And if I'm not mistaken, when he was in Congress, Pierce advocated for selling off public lands to make up for budget deficits.
Yeah, exactly.
And we should also say here that the Western Energy Alliance, it's perhaps not surprising that they're supportive of Pierce, since Kathleen Sagama, the previous nominee, was the president of the Western Energy Alliance.
Yes, exactly.
You also got a comment from Dan Ritzman, a representative from the Sierra Club, about Pierce's nomination. They were much less excited. Let's listen to what Ritzman told you.
He will not have in mind the values that are in these landscapes that are important to all of us, whether it's clean water or places to hunt and fish or places to recreate or the economic value of visitors coming to our communities. He's going to put the values of the oil and gas industry and their leaders first.
Hannah, what did you make of Ritzman's argument there?
Yeah, I mean, he basically said this nomination is just bad news overall for public lands. And Ritzman, you know, he lives in New Mexico. He's been following Pierce for a long time. He pointed to the League of Conservation Voters ranks all these people in Congress for how like environmentally friendly they are. And this league has classified 96% of Pierce's votes as anti-environment. And, you know, some people like Ritzman are worried that this nomination could mean more proposals to sell off lots of public land, like we saw earlier this summer from Utah's Mike Lee. You know, that didn't go through, but I think we're expecting to see a lot more of these arguments in the years to come. You know, I should note that, like, in order to sell off a lot of, like, wide swaths of public land, this typically has to come through Congress. Like, the BLM director can't really make these moves unilaterally. But, you know, we are seeing more and more people at the top that the Trump administration is nominating, favoring these kinds of ideas. You know, we have Interior Secretary Doug Burgum as well. And, you know, this all comes as the Trump administration tries to unleash American energy. And I think everyone I'm talking to says this nomination puts us in that direction.
All right. Well, that is Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach. Hannah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Governors from across the West gathered at a Paradise Valley resort over the weekend to discuss some of the most pressing issues facing us all, from water to energy to a debate over RFK Jr.'s vaccine skepticism. Of course, KJZZ's politics desk covered it all, and we're joined now in studio by our own Wayne Shutsky to tell us more about what went down. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so first, who was there? This is sort of a who's who of Western politics, right, from all parties.
Yeah, it's a really big policy meeting. So we had the chair of the Western Governors Association, Spencer Cox from Utah, Republican governor, Josh Green from Hawaii, the Montana governor. We had the governor from, I believe, from Idaho, And then as well, Katie Hobbs, our own governor, was there along with just a bunch of interested parties from policy side, from government side, and then two special keynotes from the Trump administration, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and RFK Jr., the health secretary.
Yeah. Okay. West all the way to Hawaii. Okay. So let's dive into some of the big issues they tackled, Wayne, the most important of which seemed to be energy and how we're going to make enough of it in the face of just what sounds like exploding demand. You wrote that the theme of this year's Western Governors Association conference was superabundance.
Yeah, that's what they called it. But then I think I noted in the piece that covering this that really the talk was how we don't have enough right now. Like, I think the superabundance was kind of like a looking forward, like we can get there. But yeah, the talk is that basically between population growth and Western, I believe all the Western states attending have populations that are growing. In addition to those AI data centers, which just suck up energy and need more as AI becomes more complicated and requires more energy to do what it does. We need to produce more energy. That was the big takeaway from this conference.
And when we say more, like just way, way, way more, right?
Yeah, the scale of this is one hard real to imagine. Like drop the mic moment that I saw during a data center talk was one project. There was one project, I think, in Wyoming in the future that could potentially need 10 gigawatts of energy. And Governor Cox from Utah pointed out that currently the state of Wyoming uses under a gigawatt on its own entirely. So that just kind of shows you the scale.
Yeah. Okay. So you had the chair of this association, Utah Governor Spencer Cox, like you said, as well as U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum there. And they both kind of talked about this energy issue. They had kind of different takes here, right?
Yeah. So they're both on the same page that we need more energy. We need it now. And also that like permitting reform is going to be a big part of this on the federal level. As we just heard in the previous conversation, federal lands cover so much of the West. And so sometimes it can take years and years and years to get whether it's a transmission line or a power project itself off the ground because of all of the permitting. So they both agreed that speeding up that permitting process is a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actually where the energy is going to come from, Spencer Cox said all of the above. You know, we need to take new technologies. We need to go back to old ones like nuclear. We need to do everything. Whereas the Trump administration has been squarely against renewable energy. And so it wasn't surprising that Burgum came out pretty strong and was like, as we need more energy, he was like, renewables, no. He's like, the Trump administration policies have favored oil, gas, has done some permitting reform on its own, but it has excluded renewables.
Right. And the Trump administration has, you know, canceled one of the biggest solar projects that was supposed to come online. Like, there's a lot of movement against that. What's his argument against renewables? Like, why not adopt all of the energy like sources we can as we need them in the future?
I wish I would have gotten to ask him that. I followed him around quite a bit. And, he kept telling me he was going into meetings and I was not able to ask that question specifically. But the argument he put forward in his speech was essentially that it's not reliable, that, you know, you don't want your light switch to be reliant on whether it's sunny outside, which is a tried and true criticism from opponents of renewable energy. I will say advocates kind of scoff at that these days, given
battery storage and
all that kind of thing, and that the mix that we have. And Spencer Cox kind of said as much. He said he agreed with some of the projects they've canceled, but he did say solar with batteries should be a part of the mix.
Okay. Let's talk about water then, because the debate over energy demand is closely tied to the issue of water, right? Because data centers also use a lot of water, and we are running out of it here in the West, especially when it comes to Colorado River water. Western states who rely on Colorado River water are kind of locked in this battle over essentially like who's going to have to cut more in the future because the river is drying up. They just missed a deadline to kind of come to a deal, and it's kind of looking like the federal government's going to have to step in here. Spencer Cox said at this conference he thinks that the states can avoid that. How?
Yeah, maybe some wishful thinking, but he did say it would be in their best interest to keep the feds out.
Let's hear what he had to say there.
What matters is that I don't think any of us really want the federal government or a judge to make the ultimate decision, that it's better if we do that together. And I'm confident that we'll get there.
So, Wayne, what did he have to say about how?
Yeah, we didn't get a lot of specifics on the how. And I will say that Governor Hobbs is very much more pessimistic about that because they, like you said, they missed this deadline earlier this month and they've really been locked in this thing. And what Hobbs has said is that the lower basin, you know, Arizona, California, we're making these cuts and we're proposing these cuts. But that she's accused the upper basin, of which Cox is a part with Utah, of basically refusing to take any cuts. And all Cox said was, if I was a lower basin state, I'd probably feel the same way. So I will say, we thought going into this meeting that water was going to be the biggest topic, and we didn't actually hear a lot of it on the stage. Hmm. But I have speaking of chasing Burgum around to all those private meetings, I suspect a lot of talk was happening in the background on that.
Quick question on the farm bill, which became a big topic at the at this conference. The governors want it updated, reauthorized. What's that going to look like?
Yeah, so farm bill is this massive package of legislation that affects everything from farm subsidies to how they get their insurance, just affects how food is grown in this state. And it's typically reauthorized every 5 years, but it hasn't been reauthorized since 2018. And so essentially what the governors are saying, it's been renewed on a yearly basis, but it's not updated. So what the governors are saying is like it's out of date. It hasn't adjusted for the inflation that we're facing, all these different things. And so they really just need it to be brought up to date for these farmers. It also affects things like wildfires and how we handle that. And so stability in that area is needed. Some of the governors who deal with a lot of wildfires said so. That's really what they're looking for. We didn't get a lot of, again, specifics about what exactly the update will look like, but they did say, you know, it's outdated.
Yeah.
We need you guys to take care of that in Congress.
Okay, so final question then, Wayne. We have to hit on kind of one of the most controversial figures who showed up to speak at this conference, which, of course, is Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. What did he have to say?
So his kind of gave the stump speech that we heard when he was running for president. It was a lot about chronic disease in this country and trying to fight that. Nothing super new. The governors really wanted to hear about other things like this big rural pocket of money for rural hospitals, but he didn't really have much to say on that. Most of the time was honestly taken up on a vaccine debate between him and Governor Green from Hawaii, who is a doctor. Very cordial. This whole meeting was very cordial, but kind of just pushing back and forth on each other. Green kind of suggesting RFK's positions are undermining public health because people aren't more skeptical of vaccines than ever. And RFK kind of reiterating why he feels the way he does and that he's trying to give people all the information so they can make their own decisions on that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Whole lot happening in Paradise Valley over the weekend. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a local marching band is slated to perform at this year's Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. We'll hear more about their preparations before they head to New York.
But first, Haley Williams is one of the top breakaway ropers in the world. As of the end of September, the 21-year-old Texan was fifth place in the Women's Professional Rodeo Association's Pro Rodeo Breakaway World Standings. She's earned more than $130,000 this year, and she'll be looking to defend her title at the Kimes Ranch Million Dollar Breakaway at Westworld in Scottsdale. The event was originally scheduled for this week, but has had to be postponed because of an outbreak in horse communities of a virus known as EHV1. Breakaway roping is similar to tie-down roping, except in breakaway, after the rider catches the calf, they let it go rather than tying it down. And Williams is one of the best there is at doing it. Our co-host, Mark Brody, spoke with her more about this, and they started with the fact that Williams got into this sport in part because of her parents. Her dad is Pro Rodeo Hall of Famer Ken Speed Williams.
So my mom actually breakawayed a little bit in her youth, but she was a professional polo player. And then my dad was a team roper and tie down roper. And all I did was grow up team roping. And so then when that happened, it was kind of crazy just because I was in sixth grade and my dad was like, you probably need a breakaway for the all round. And I was kind of like lagging a little bit about it, but it worked out and I kind of fell in love with the sport.
So I'm sorry, you started doing this when you were in sixth grade. So you were like 12 or 13 years old?
Yep, I was 12.
Wow. Like, you must have been the youngest person doing this, I would imagine, by quite a bit.
No, there's actually a lot of girls. There's a lot of girls that start at like 6 or 7.
Huh.
Honestly.
Do you remember the first time you got on a horse?
No, I was 2 weeks old when I sat on my first horse with my dad.
You were 2 weeks old. My goodness. Do you remember the first time you sat on a horse by yourself?
No, I think I was 2 when they would let me sit on a horse at the time we had Dollar. He was one of my dad's good head horses. And, so no, I don't really remember.
Wow.
The first time. I wish I did. That'd be cool. But
that'd be tough if you were 2.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, so besides sort of your parents' connection to it, what attracts you to rodeo and specifically, this breakaway roping?
I think a lot of it, you know, rodeoing itself is very much a hard sport. It's different than a lot of other events because, you know, baseball players, football players, they're all on a contract and they get paid to show up and compete versus like us, we pay for our fuel, we pay for the entry fees to go to the rodeo, and then how we compete is how we make money. And like, as you get better, the more brand partnership deals you get, and that's kind of how you end up making a lot of your money, is through that too. But a lot of it comes down to, you know, you have to be the best, and or at least striving to be the best, to eventually make a living out of this.
Well, so you are one of the more successful people doing this. Was it difficult to get to that point for you?
I think for sure, no event or sport you're going to be good at the first time you do it, or at least continue to stay good if you're trying to, you know, improve yourself. But I will say I got pretty lucky. I had, my dad's very much, he trains people here. He teaches people how to rope. And so it's always kind of a, you know, every day in the practice pen is a lesson, in a sense of we're trying to work on things, we're trying to get better. So, you know, if we go to a jackpot and we don't do as good as we want to, okay, we take the good out and we look at the bad too, and we really study the bad on what we need to change, and then we change it for the next time.
Have you found that you have had to make adjustments to how you think about what you're doing, or how you do what you do over those years?
For sure. I've had some injuries along the way that have made me kind of create some bad habits that I'm trying to figure out and learn how to overcome. But I think that's all kind of part of the process. I don't think there's very many athletes that haven't had at least like one injury or so. Just, you know, you kind of hope that it stays away from the ligaments or tendons. And sadly, mine have been with ligaments and tendons a lot of the time. I haven't broken very many bones. It's just been, you know, a tear here or a strain here, or, you know. And so those are really hard to, like, let yourself sit and rest long enough that you give it a good time to, you know, be ready to come back at full speed. But I think if you look at any run I've made, there's something I could tell you that I needed to change about it. So I don't think there's ever going to be a time that I tell you, oh, yeah, it was perfect on that run.
So you mentioned injuries, and I want to ask you about one that you had not all that long ago where it sounds like a horse kind of fell on you. Is that right?
That's correct. Unloading out of the trailer.
And like what exactly happened?
We were actually getting back. It was really late at night. We had been to rodeos that whole weekend, and we had just gotten back home. And I went to unload him, and he just slipped. And instead of like a normal horse will just fall down the ramp and then stand up, and I think he got scared. I was in front of him trying to back out, or just get him to back up. And when he went to fall, he just lunged forward and tackled me on the trailer ramp and stepped on my foot and stepped on my knee. And he's one of the biggest horses I'd ever actually owned at that point. And so having even just a little horse fall on you is going to hurt something, but having a horse as big as that horse was fall, it's going to mess up a lot of things. And it's kind of crazy because when he stepped on me, it was October 7th. And then the 8th and 9th, I was kind of like, my foot was hurting, but it wasn't like major. And then I go to my circuit finals in Texas, and my foot was killing me all the way to the circuit finals. And I'm like, I don't know what's up. Like, I know I got fell, you know, my horse fell on me, but I mean, I've been roping and riding horses the last 2 days. And then it just, I think I overused it right after it happened. And so it was probably strained, and then me using it and continuing to go, because, you know, kind of the rodeo motto is if it isn't broken, you just keep going.
Yeah.
Like, unless it's really like dangling, you don't stop. And so I think that was definitely a lesson I have to, you know, look back and be like, okay, did I probably do the smartest thing? But I mean, if it happened again, you wouldn't really know if something's hurt or not. And you don't really have time to just go to the doctor and get a, you know, an x-ray just for fun.
Now, can I ask how old you are right now?
I'm 21.
21. And so you've been obviously doing this, as we've established, for quite a while. Do you have a sense of for how long you would like to keep doing this?
I don't really know. That's a hard question, because I think anyone's career can be determined by a couple factors. Right now, I have a really good group of horses that are with me. But to be honest, the main reason I'm out here rodeoing is because I feel like this is my calling, where I was supposed to be. When I was going through high school, I was planning on, my dad was going to buy my good horse Red Light that I won all the money at Kimes on last year. He was going to buy me out of that horse, and I was going to go to nursing school and plan to be a NICU nurse or labor and delivery. And, you know, I didn't feel peace about it. And so I kept, you know, searching and asking questions, and I was still seasoning Red Light at the time, kind of trying to figure out, you know, because rodeo was still paying for a lot of the things I had going on, and I had a full ride to this really good nursing school, and I just had to do a rodeo for them. And then it's kind of been a whirlwind, honestly, because I feel like I was just turned 18 and I still had another year. I graduated at 19 and, you know, my 18, that's when I could go pro. And so I kept, you know, experiencing, you know, kind of just asking the Lord where he wanted me to go and show me where he wanted me, because I really wanted to do nursing, and I truly felt like that kid being like, I really want this. Can you just tell me this is okay so I can just do what I want? And every time I kept asking, it kind of was shut down in one way or the other, or something happened and I'd go to a different rodeo and I'd win. And it's just, it's honestly, looking back, it's crazy how I didn't look like see it at the time, but it's so easy to look back and see God's hand and everything that went on throughout my like 17 to 19 year old age.
That was leading breakaway roper Haley Williams speaking with our co-host Mark Brody. The Kimes Ranch Million Dollar Breakaway is set to take place the week of December 15th.
Over the weekend, we saw a series of sometimes conflicting headlines about progress towards a potential peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. Deliberations are ongoing this morning, as President Trump has pressed for a resolution by the end of the week. For the latest on that, as well as some other top stories from around the globe, I am joined now by the BBC's Pete Ross. Pete, let's begin with the latest on these peace talks that took place in Geneva yesterday. Where do we stand?
Yeah, we've heard from the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, that there's been tremendous progress made in these talks that were hastily arranged in Switzerland over the weekend. Mr. Rubio also says that there are just a couple of issues left to be resolved. Now, as I mentioned, these talks were hastily put together between the U.S., Ukraine and European nations after the U.S. proposed peace deal kind of emerged over the weekend. It seemed to be heavily skewed in favour of Russia, so much so that Mr. Rubio had to confirm that it had indeed been written by Washington and not the Kremlin. So we've had this meeting taking place in Switzerland over the last 24 hours or so, and we've heard a lot of positive things coming. Donald Trump himself has said that, you know, perhaps we could be getting some very good news soon, and indeed he's put a deadline of this Thursday for this deal to get over the line. And as I just mentioned moments ago, Marco Rubio seems to suggest that the original 28-point peace plan, which many had suggested was written by the Kremlin, but as I've said, Washington insists was not, that that has been reworked with Ukraine and European allies. And there's just a couple of sticking points. However, I think that's the key line there. There could be some very, very big issues that Ukraine will not move on, and neither will Russia. Things like giving up territory. We're getting noises from Kyiv today that they just won't budge on those kind of issues. The other thing we have to take into account, of course, is all of these negotiations that have gone on the last 24 hours or so have been from one side. It's been the US, Europe, and Ukraine. We need to know how these new proposals are going to be accepted by Moscow. They haven't seen those proposals. You have to think it's going to take some time for something to be drafted up, which then makes its way to Moscow. That then gets considered before there is a response. So considering there's a deadline of Thursday put on this by Donald Trump, I would be very surprised indeed if we have anything concrete coming out by then. But things can move fast, and who knows? So let's keep our eye on this one.
Well, let's move to Nigeria now, Pete, where more than 300 children and staff were abducted from a school on Friday. That followed claims from Washington that Islamist militants there are systematically targeting Christians in the country. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, this abduction is thought to be the worst mass abduction the country has seen. More than 300 children and staff were kidnapped by gunmen from a Catholic school in central Nigeria. We've heard since then reports that some of those children and staff managed to escape, but we've heard conflicting reports about whether that's true or not and how many it were. Still a significant number of children and staff still being held then. And this kidnapping comes amid a surge of similar attacks by armed groups around the country. Sadly, Nigeria has seen these sorts of mass abductions before, perhaps most notably or notoriously the infamous Chibok mass abduction of 2014. That was carried out by the Boko Haram group, which when translated means Western education is forbidden. However, this latest abduction comes as kidnapping people for ransom by criminal gangs appears to be on the rise. It's a major problem across Nigeria now, and it's seen schools in at least two states in Nigeria close their doors for fears that other attacks could happen. The president of Nigeria has also called for an extra 30,000 security personnel to be trained up to help deal with the problem. Friday's abduction that we've just mentioned there was the third such attack in the country in a week. On Monday of last week, 20 schoolgirls, the BBC was told, were Muslim, were kidnapped from a boarding school in neighbouring or in the Kebbi state. Now, as I say, this all comes after months from campaigners and politicians in Washington, including President Donald Trump, alleging that Islamist militants are systematically targeting Christians. But given some of the details that I've just given you there and the fact that it appears that gangs abducting children for ransom, for money, appears to be on the rise, the picture is not clear as to why these attacks are happening and why they're on the rise.
Well, finally this week, Pete, Pope Leo will visit Turkey and Lebanon later this week. Why is this trip significant?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it is the first overseas trip for the American-born Pope when he travels on Thursday to Turkey for a six-day trip, which will also see him go to Lebanon. When he's going to Turkey, he's going to meet the president there, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It's a predominantly Muslim country. I think it's only something like 0.2% of Turkey's 86 million inhabitants are Christian. But it's significant that he's going to a country like that and meeting the president. However, I think eyes will be particularly on his visit to Lebanon, particularly given the recent war with Israel and the attacks that seems to have been stepped up again in recent days. The fact that the Pope will be in that country while Israeli attacks have happened recently, promoting a message of Christian unity and urging peace efforts, I think, you know, couldn't come at a more significant time.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on all of these developments this week. That is the BBC's Pete Ross keeping us in the loop. Pete, thank you as always.
Always great to be with you, Sam. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. John Hetrick spent his career working at SRP here in the Valley. In his downtime, he loves to read. For years, when it came to books, he had a type, long novels by American authors. But recently, with some gentle pressure from his wife, he decided to expand his horizons. That's when he discovered the New York Times list of the top 100 books of the 21st century. Hetrick decided he was going to make it through the entire list.
I was looking for new inspiration, and I came upon the list, and I was like, this has a much broader spectrum of topics and genres than I normally read. And so I said, this could be kind of I counted what I had already read up to the 25. And I was like, I should probably read all of these.
Okay. So that must have been very affirming to find out, you know, having been reading for as long as you had been, that there were a good number. You said it was about 25?
That's pretty close, yes.
I mean, that's a quarter of the list.
Yeah.
That
it's a good start.
You were already... You know, it's kind of affirming of your taste.
Yes. And I would, again, refer back to my wife, who was, taught at ASU. She's a poet.
Uh-huh.
And so I have a great fondness for literary fiction.
So you did decide to formalize this as a mission, right?
Absolutely.
Like, I'm going to make it through all 100.
Yes.
Okay. And so how did you start? Are you going in order?
I'm not. I decided to start at the bottom of the list.
Okay.
And the book at the bottom of the list is Dennis Johnson's Tree of Smoke, which I had already read and knew that I liked. But my thought was, if I already know that I like something at the bottom of the list, that is, I progress upwards, then I would probably enjoy them more and more as I went along.
Right. You're like, if the floor is a book I already love, I can't wait to see what's on the ceiling.
Exactly. Yeah. And I always, you know, if you know, I'm eating food, I usually save the best bite for last, or that kind of thing.
A man after my own heart. Okay. So you mentioned this tendency towards literary fiction. But there are some very notable works of literary nonfiction on this list. In particular, what is that book about Lyndon Johnson?
Oh, The Passage of Power by Robert Carl.
Yes. The Passage of Power and Emperor of Maladies.
It's about a biography of cancer.
Okay. Tell me about what you connected with.
They're two very different books. The one, The Passage of Power, with Lyndon B. Johnson. And this is just the years from when he is contemplating running for presidency, doesn't get the nomination, becomes the vice presidential candidate for John F. Kennedy, and then eventually becomes president. And so it's those kind of 5 years there. It's a deep dive into it, just, you know, how politics took place back then.
Yeah.
It's how I think a lot of people view it now, but it was so much more corrupt, and just those sorts of things. Like, he was put on the ticket with Kennedy, pretty much to get Texas in the South, and I think there was a lot of voter fraud involved with getting him Texas. You know, even though he's from Texas, and we've heard those stories a lot.
Well, tell me about what you resonated with in The Emperor of All Maladies, which I should say is by Siddhartha Mukherjee.
That book is much more personal to me. I'm currently a stage 3 cancer patient.
Oh.
So learning about cancer, I was a little nervous about approaching that book. Things were going very well for me. I'm
good,
in remission
good.
For 3.5 years.
Okay.
But it's a little bit of a tender subject for me.
Of course.
And the one that just opened my eye in the book was breast cancer. And just I had no idea, like, the progression of treatment for it and how, you know, up until like 30, 40 years ago, you know, a radical mastectomy was really like – I would almost say it was torture to do to people. And so learning that and following it, it was just nothing that I would have ever approached if it had not been for this list of books.
Wow. I mean, that to me is such a testament to the value of a project like the one you're undertaking, where you have this hesitancy towards particular subject matter because it has very real personal stakes. But if I'm hearing you right, undertaking the project pushes you a little bit out of your comfort zone, and then it ends up being a rewarding experience.
Oh, absolutely. And it's done that in so many different areas.
So, John, I would love to go ahead and anoint you as a tastemaker, because as we were talking about at the beginning, you know, you had actually already of your own accord in consultation with your wife, read a bunch of the books that, you know, the gray lady has decided we should all be reading. So I'm curious to know, are there any favorite books of yours that don't appear on the Times list that you would put forward as significant books, books that if we were making the John Hetrick list, you would recommend?
Well, definitely. One that comes to mind right away is Leif Enger, a book called I Cheerfully Refuse. And I started reading him because we like to travel a lot, my wife and I like to read books from the places we're going. And so we spent maybe 2 or 3 months in Minnesota over the last couple of years, and he is a Minnesota writer. And so that's what introduced me to him. And the book is a kind of a post-apocalyptic, you know, future of America. And there are books on the list that do that, Station 11, On the Road. And I really enjoyed – I've read both of those, really enjoyed them. This book, though, kind of had a I would say almost a brighter, more buoyant take on it. It was, you know, it's based on a classic, you know, story, somebody helping a child find the parent in the future. But it was so positive.
A positive spin on dystopia.
Yes.
Anything else that from the John Hetrick Readerly Archives?
One, you know, another one that comes to mind is the Eighth Life for Burka that takes place in Georgia, and it's basically covers, you know, eight generations of a family. And when I say Georgia, it's not Georgia, the United States, it's Georgia, the country.
Right.
And so we, a few years ago, were going to Georgia. And so I looked up who were, you know, well-known authors from Georgia and found this book.
And I should say, we did look this up. The author's name is Nino Haratishvili. Nino, if you're listening, I apologize if I got it wrong.
So the book is a grand tale that takes place pre-Soviet Union, before, you know, Georgia becomes a member of the Soviet Union, and post. And it's really the part of the premise is a little, you know, I probably wouldn't have approached it. Is this family, but they have a secret hot chocolate recipe. And so that underlies these eight generations. But it went through, you know, so much of the history of Georgia. So that's kind of the grand story that will hopefully attract a lot of other people.
Well, I think you have probably attracted a lot of people to a number of the books on this list in this conversation. I have been speaking with John Hetrick, who is a big reader and also for 26 years worked at Salt River Project on water and sustainability projects, a variety of other things. John, thank you for this conversation.
Well, thank you, Sam. This was a pleasure.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. So, Sam, are you one of the people like me who watches the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade every year?
Oh, yes. I think of it as like a part of the texture of the day.
Yes. It needs to be on.
Exactly.
And we got to see Santa. And there's the thing. Yeah.
Of course. And all the floats.
Well, if you tune in on Thursday, you'll also get to see one of our own Arizona marching bands center stage. This year, Northern Arizona University's marching band was one of very few selected for the honor of performing in the big parade. They'll be bringing about 250 students to New York City for the performance, and they're practicing diligently for their big moment on the big screen when they go through Herald Square. I spoke more about it with NAU Director of Band Stephen Meyer and drum major Samantha Fagan, beginning with the students' reaction when they got the news that they were heading to the big parade.
It was so exciting. We were actually performing our halftime performance, and our director had us just arc up on the field. We didn't know what was going to happen, but we knew there was a surprise. And then the president of our university actually came onto the field and gave a big speech about the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And all of us just, oh my gosh, we just jumped with excitement. I was just like looking at my parents in the audience, like, oh my gosh, waving, jumping up and down, hugging my friends around me. It was crazy.
What was it like for you, Stephen, as you know, the guy in charge?
It was amazing to see their reaction. That happened at the end of August, and we had known since the end of the previous April that we were invited to perform. So we had been hanging on to the secret for months from the students, trying to make sure that we gave it the most attention that we could in the best space.
Oh, that's so great.
Those faces and that reaction were something that we will never forget.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to give folks a sense of just how big a deal this is, how hard it is for a marching band to get to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. How many are selected each year?
Between 6 and 7 high school and college marching bands out of maybe over 100 that apply. So it is a huge deal and is a testament to the work that we have done at NAU and tried to build the marching band program over the last 8 years since I've been here.
Yeah, and it sounds like it has grown quite a bit in that time as well. Tell us a little bit about how you've been preparing for this. I mean, like, this is a big stage. It is a big deal to be here. It costs a lot of money to get everyone there. I'm sure you've been practicing a lot.
Yeah, we have to practice. We practice Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We've been doing lots of parade practice over and over and over, getting every detail just to make it as perfect as possible.
You have to be like incredibly detail oriented for this, right? Like to get that many people in formation, and then it'll be different, right? When you're on a route in New York City with, you know, cameras and people and maybe snow, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we've been practicing our Macy's performance like on a football field, but Macy's, there's no football field. So that's something that's super different. And we have to be super attentive to every detail and making sure everyone knows all of their counts, all of the choreography, just to make sure that no one gets hurt or anything.
What instrument do you play, Samantha?
I play the saxophone.
But do you play in this, or as a drum major?
No,
you're not playing,
I don't.
Right?
I'm the one of the banner holders. The three of us just hold the banner throughout the streets.
And keep everybody in line, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Let me ask you about what you'll be playing. I mean, like, you get to pick, I'm sure, a certain number of songs, but kind of one major moment when you're going to be on screen. How did you come up with that? What are you going to play?
So for our Herald Square performance, one of the things that you want to do is highlight what is great about our area. And certainly the first thing that came to mind was Route 66. And we found the Get Your Kicks on Route 66, that song. There's a version by John Mayer that was used in the movie Cars. So we selected that last April or something, and afterwards found out that this year is the centennial anniversary of Route 66. So it was this harmonious moment where we could celebrate a huge milestone for Flagstaff in this national spotlight.
Yeah, what amazing synchronicity there. That's amazing.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And then on the parade route, we're going to play Pink Pony Club. We're also going to play Ghostbusters and Lady Gaga's Bad Romance. We wanted to pick music that was entertaining to the crowd.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to do this parade back in 2009 when I taught a high school in a high school in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And we played Ghostbusters and in front of the New York Public Library. I will never forget just everyone along the parade route chanting Ghostbusters.
That's
and
so
how
fun.
Cool that was. So we thought with Pink Pony Club, folks could sing along, Bad Romance the same way, mm-hmm. some way to get the crowd engaged in the parade using our music.
Yeah. What's your favorite, Samantha? What do you want to play most? What are you looking forward to here?
Oh, definitely Ghostbusters. I mean, I never even thought that I could even, like, we could even, like, do that. Like, it doesn't even need to be Halloween. It's just so iconic.
That'll be really fun. I wonder, do you think that, you know, the folks at home who watch this parade every year and know that marching bands are part of it, but don't really know much beyond that, do you think they have any inkling of just how much goes into this for these bands like yours?
I really
don't.
There is an enormous amount behind the scenes to get the students to New York City with their instruments and the logistics and coordination involved. A lot of people also don't know the massive amount of fundraising that our students and our community has done. We've been able to raise about $250,000, which has all gone to our students to help offset the cost of the trip.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so final question for you both then. I mean, we talked a little bit about what you're looking forward to here, but I wonder what you, like, how you think you'll look back on this, right? Like, you've gotten to do this once before, it sounds like, Stephen, with another band. And mm-hmm. Samantha, this, I'm assuming, will be your first time performing in this parade. How do you think you'll remember this?
I mean, it's not very common to say that you were able to be a part of the Macy's Parade. You just kind of watch it on the TV. You're like, dang, that's cool. But you never really actually think that you could actually be in, like, on camera in front of, like, all those people and just, like, representing, like, your school. So I'm definitely going to look back on this with just, like, so much excitement and just, like, wow, like, it actually happened.
What will you all do for Thanksgiving dinner after you're done playing?
After the parade, we are going on a riverboat cruise around the Hudson River, and that's where we will have Thanksgiving dinner and just a wonderful celebration of all the hard work and their performance that day.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck to you both. Happy Thanksgiving. That is Stephen Meyer, the NAU Director of Bands and Associate Professor of Music at NAU, as well as one of three drum majors, Samantha Fagan, joining us. Thank you both.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Come on, let's turkey try.
I think our director has been waiting to play this one all year.
I think I see some fist pumps in the booth there.
Well, happy Thanksgiving coming up here to everyone. And that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.